What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, and welcome to Outward, Slate's monthly show about the L's, the G's, the B's, the T's, and, oh yes, the Q's as well. I'm Jules Gill Peterson, America's favorite female Grinch impersonator.
I'm Christina Cotterucci, a senior writer at Slate.
And I'm Brian Lauder, and I edit things at Slate.
Well, it's December, and that means, I guess, that the year 2022 is almost over?
Oh, okay. What a great showing.
I'm sorry, I thought it was 2020 still, but whatever. In a tribute to a year that was certainly a mixed bag for us queers, we've got two segments that sort of have a lot of food for thought. So one of them reflects on a really painful impact of anti-LGBTQ violence this year, and the other digs into some new possibilities for trans storytelling and filmmaking. So first, we'll talk through our very complicated feelings about one of the responses to the shooting at Club Q in Colorado Springs last month, which is the kind of question of whether we should be organizing in self-defense, or how, or whether we should maybe even be arming ourselves for protection. Christina, Brian, and I will bring a few interesting examples and even some historical precedents to unpack together. And then, hey, have you heard, listeners? I'm in a movie. Okay, sorry. That's the really selfish version of it. Let me try that again. A new hybrid documentary film, Framing Agnes, is premiering in New York, LA, and select cities in North America. The film explores the never-before-seen stories of trans people whose case files from the University of California, Los Angeles in the 1950s were unearthed by filmmaker Chase Joint and brought to life by a star-studded cast. One of those stars, the ultra-talented Jen Richards, is joining us to talk about the film in which I, to come clean, am your humble narrator. We'll also have our usual prides and provocations and updates to the gay agenda. But first, we have something to share from our thoughts and queries inbox. We received a really heartfelt voice memo from Quigley, who felt the impact of the New York Times article on puberty blockers we discussed last month quite intensely, in part because they've had to deal with osteoporosis for real, but actually because they were forced by their parents and an endocrinologist to take birth control as a teenager to try and make them more gender conforming and basically cis, which was exactly the opposite of what they needed at that time in their life. So let's listen to a little bit of what Quigley had to share with us.
At this endocrinologist, I was given a bone scan, and then my parents were told that if I did not consent to taking estrogen-based birth control every day, that I would be on a Zimmer frame at 30, which, one, is ableist as fuck, and also is not true, because birth control is not a treatment for bone density loss or lack of growth. I was forced against my will to take those pills for 10 years.
So our thanks, really. Thank you, Quigley, for sharing that very powerful and personal testimony. Again, I just think really speaking to the fact that there are stories, you know, mm-hmm. sitting behind mm-hmm. all of the headlines that we hear or that we see landing in our news feeds. There are real lives impacted, and the stories that are actually there are not always the ones that we're being told about in the media. If you have a thought or query for us, please let us know. You can write to us at outwardpodcast@slate.com. But we especially love to hear your gorgeous voices. So you could also send us a voice memo like Quigley if you're so inclined.
Yes, we absolutely love to hear your voices. We have yet to have someone send us a singing thought or query, but I'm hoping that sometime before this time next year, we'll get our first one. Perhaps it could be you. On that note, who's proud? Who's provoked? Let's share our prides and provocations. Brian, how are you feeling this month?
So despite not getting an invitation myself, I have to say that I'm proud this month of the slightly chaotic gay who seems to have done the guest list for the Respect for Marriage Act signing at the White House. This happened earlier this month. You know, President Biden signed the RMA, I believe it's being called, and there was a big gathering of various important people there for it. And we saw some, you know, coverage in the press about who these people were. You know, normally this kind of political theater doesn't really like interest me very much, but the reports from this made it sound like it was a real mix of different folks from the community. You know, we had the typical sort of power gays like Chad Griffin and Hillary Rosen. There's a really great piece in New York Magazine in the Intelligencer by Sean McCreesh that's like the sort of page six of like who all was there and like the after parties and stuff. Apparently the Acela Amtrak train from New York to DC that morning was really popping off. But in addition to those folks, we also had drag performers like Shangela, Britta Filter, and Marty Cummings were in attendance, which, you know, is not insignificant statement at this moment when drag and, you know, the dangers that it poses to the children have become the right's obsession. But then there were also like some middling DJs, like actors that you've seen in like one episode of American Horror Story. Sam Smith like sang a song, as did Cyndi Lauper. And then I just saw people on Instagram who had like no apparent reason for being there, like taking selfies, except for being gay, I guess, or queer. So I don't know. The whole thing felt like this sort of time warp from 10 years ago somehow, but like, I don't know. I guess given all the attacks that we're under these days, like we should celebrate when we can. And yes, chaotic gay at the White House event department, put us on the list next time, please.
Jules, what's up with you this month?
Well, I'm feeling very proud. I think it's a pride we all share. You know, this pride has to do with memes. It has to do with Jennifer Coolidge. It has to do with the unbelievable gay memes that Jennifer Coolidge has gifted us in the season 2 finale of The White Lotus. I don't want to spoil anything.
Thank you. I still actually
I just watched it last night.
I was about to leave the room.
No spoilers, but let's just say if you want high stakes gay chicanery, if you want Jennifer Coolidge delivering memorable lines that include the gays over and over again, for example, maybe like,
please, these gays, they're trying to murder me.
And things like that, well, then you're going to want to tune in and watch this entire season of The White Lotus, which of course, you know, Mike White is gifting us. You know, ass for the ages when it comes to the silver screen, and then just to get what we get from our goddess, from our Lord and Savior Jennifer Coolidge. I mean, I am not the first person to say it, and I will not be the last. But mwah, we love. Thank you, darling. You truly, truly did something unique and memorable, and frankly, exactly what I needed. Mm-hmm. Like just the perfect feeling to cap off a really weird year. so grateful for that.
Well, I hate to break it to you guys, but I'm provoked again. So I don't know if you guys read this story that I published yesterday. It was really buzzy, I should say. I found through a tipster, thank you to that person, Kyrsten Sinema's Facebook Marketplace account. Kyrsten Sinema, you know, noted bisexual in the U.S. Senate from Arizona. She's selling all kinds of items, mostly related to triathlon stuff, like racing bikes and cycling gear and outfits from this brand whose slogan is badass is beautiful and do epic shit. And they love putting periods after every word. So here's why I'm provoked, and I'm allowed to bring this in, although it's not specifically LGBT related, because she is, as I've mentioned before, a bi. Kyrsten Sinema is charging on her Facebook Marketplace account $30 for a trucker hat that retail new costs $29.99, casting shame on the entire LGBT community.
Oh my God.
A markup on her used hat. A trucker hat, no less. a Twitter user named Graf Massara tweeted, "All I can really say about this is that no bisexual is ever truly free from the trap of buying and reselling weird clothes online." We've received confirmation on that fact from one of our buys here at Slate. So it's gospel as far as I'm concerned. And that to me means that if Kyrsten Sinema is conducting herself poorly on Facebook Marketplace, it reflects poorly on the entire bi community. And that's something that provokes me. The other part of it is that her office would not confirm to me that it was her, even though a truly insane number of coincidences would have had to align for this to not be her, plus like someone probably stalking her. And it was obviously her, but because they couldn't confirm it, you know, for legal reasons, I had to be kind of sly in the piece. The fact that she couldn't even confirm that to her queer sibling, I mean, come on, we all use the internet. Buys apparently are specifically known for buying and reselling cycling gear online. I don't know. I don't want to disparage anybody. And then, hours after I published the piece, on December 15th, a local reporter from Arizona published a blog post saying, "I have been reporting on Kyrsten Sinema since the mid-2000s when, you know, she was coming up in Arizona politics. And at that time, as kind of a hazard of the job, you had to be following all these people on Facebook because that was where a lot of stuff went down before Facebook became the purview of all of our boomer parents and apparently this Gen X clothing resale senator." But so this reporter, this Arizona reporter said, you know, "I clicked on some of these links in Christina Cotterucci's article. And yes, the person selling those things is indeed the same Kyrsten Sinema that I've been following since the mid-2000s and with whom I have, you know, 143 mutual friends. It's actually her." So they have since confirmed it, which is why I can say with no qualifications on this podcast that Kyrsten Sinema is selling her used bikinis on Facebook Marketplace. The whole boondoggle has kind of provoked me as much as it has also delighted me. It has not given me particular pride to be under the same LGBT umbrella as Kyrsten Sinema.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
And it would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
and activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
So in the wake of the attack at Club Q in Colorado Springs last month, I came across a post on Instagram that really caught me off guard. It was from Mary Emily O'Hara, who's a journalist who's currently working in communications at GLAAD. They had posted a video and some photos of themselves doing target practice at a shooting range. And I just want to read their caption. They wrote, "No matter how you feel about guns, it never hurts to have a little tactical training and be prepared for a potential situation. I know a lot of other queers are feeling sketched out about going to gay bars, pride, or even drag brunch because of all the threats. Personally, I want to know that if some douche shows up with a loaded AR-15 and starts pointing it at my friends, I'm at least somewhat qualified to help take him down. We keep us safe." So amid all the, you know, grief and horror that the Club Q murders elicited, a sort of militant queer answer to anti-queer violence was another kind of response. And Mary was really not alone in their conviction that, as they put it, we keep us safe. I noticed people hearkening back to historical movements of gay and trans neighborhood watches and safety patrols, like the Butterfly Brigade in San Francisco. I saw a number of other folks advocating getting nightlife workers and patrons armed. And I myself even attended an active shooter de-escalation training. You know, I think these reactions make a certain kind of sense, but they also left me feeling queasy. Are guns and self-defense training and hypervigilance really the only answer to the threats that we and our loved ones are facing? Are queerness and this kind of militancy compatible? I've been thinking about these things for the last couple of weeks, and I just am really grateful that maybe we can talk through it all today, because I think we all feel a bit queasy about this. So maybe as a starting place, I'd love to hear like what other sorts of examples of queer militant reaction that y'all saw sort of in the world after Club Q, and how did those kinds of things make you feel?
I mean, I think I paid a lot of attention to the let's arm ourselves stuff, in part because I feel like it's a thing that, you know, has been conversation, particularly among some trans women for like quite a long time, because we've like long experienced really disproportionate violence. But also, like, you know, I'm from Canada, did not grow up around guns. And also, like, you know, my family is originally from India. I grew up hearing stories about, you know, the Indian National Congress and Gandhi's, you know, nonviolent tactics, and was sort of, you know, led very much, you know, into this kind of imagination that politics should always be nonviolent and that resistance to oppression should always be nonviolent. And, you know, it's like, it's not as if life isn't very complicated and I haven't thought about those things over the years, but I feel like, you know, when there are such intense, you know, discrete events of violence, it really kind of jogs all of that and sort of brings it up to the surface. And I feel like, you know, many years ago, when I moved to America, I used to be like, oh, this, you know, cultural differences, you know, I'll still never forget, like, once I think I was landing in Arizona to do something for the weekend, and I was like, let's see who's hot on Tinder. And I, like, put out a broadcast that was like, other trans girls to the front. And I kept like seeing profiles where like the first picture was like a white trans girl in the desert with like an assault rifle, like doing you know, because there's like a whole thing there. And I remember being like, cool, so you're like not at the top of my list. I personally am not attracted to that. But like all of that feels kind of quaint, you know, when I look at, you know, obviously the context today is a little more immediate and specific. But part of it to me, I feel really caught between, I'm like, is this just a changing problem in American culture, guns and gun violence in general, right? And like LGBT people are sort of swept up in how things have changed in the last even 5, 10, 15 years, how laws have changed, you know, the degree of violence, where it takes place have changed. Or is there something really specific, right, to like queer and trans people or around LGBT public spaces like bars, right? And I'm not sure.
And I feel like that's one of the challenges or one of the ambivalences I'm still really, really feeling, you know, not just after last month, but certainly feeling it mm-hmm. anew since last month.
I totally relate to that. In fact, after the Club Q shooting, I was kind of asking myself just why I didn't feel the same kind of fear, I guess, that I felt after the Pulse massacre, which actually ended up being a little bit more complicated than it initially seemed in terms of the motive of the shooter. But I think it's just because there are so many mass shootings in the U.S. that to me, it didn't feel particularly more dangerous to go to a gay bar after Club Q than it did to go to the grocery store or a movie theater or a school or a subway or literally anywhere else. Because, you know, although obviously we know LGBTQ people are disproportionately targeted by violence and, you know, especially trans and gender nonconforming people, especially queer and trans people of color, it feels like in terms of mass shootings and not sort of individualized bias-motivated violence, it could be anyone, anywhere. And while there are hate-motivated shootings, there are also plenty of not hate-motivated shootings. So that was a really devastating realization to me that I felt like, oh yeah, you know, this sort of hate crime just sort of blends into the background of a constant feeling of like, well, it might just be a matter of time before me or someone close to me ends up in a space where a shooter shows up. I definitely am of the mindset, and this is just a fact, that like the presence of a gun anywhere makes it more likely that any sort of skirmish or argument turns deadly. Yeah. So I do not support guns as products. And I would never advocate for more arming of people, especially not LGBTQ people, especially not in LGBTQ spaces which are often spaces where like drinking and drug use happens. And especially, you know, if you have a gun in your home, you're more likely to die by suicide by gun. That scares me. Like when I think about what it means to keep us safe, I don't think that guns keep people safe. And that's sort of the bottom line for me. At the same time, I can't blame any individual people for wanting to arm themselves if that makes them feel safe. Because I think, you know, the likelihood that an armed LGBT person is going to take down a mass shooter with that gun successfully are so slim. Yeah. Like, even that you'd be in this situation, that you'd be able to do that successfully. And so it's more about how it makes an individual person feel, I think. I do think we should all train in using a firearm safely on the chance that we end up somewhere where there's a loaded firearm and we need to know how to not make it go off in a way that harms someone. You know, in preparation for this episode, I sort of looked into a couple of these different LGBTQ gun groups. And also, you know, some have sort of popped up as general, like, just sort of leftist, like anti-white supremacy armed groups that have gained popularity or started after the Charlottesville Unite the Right march and other sort of resurgent right-wing violent gatherings around the country. And doesn't feel like necessarily a trend because I'm not sure how many people are actually signed up, but it does feel like there's a not insignificant number of people who are finding some sort of comfort and empowerment in the idea of having the same deadly weapon that the people who hate us have.
Christina, you told us when we were preparing for this episode that you actually, I think as research for a story, actually got a gun, and it's, you know, we're quick to say that you don't have no bullets for it, so it's not dangerous in your house. But I wondered, I mean, just going off of what you were just talking about, like, how does that feel? Like what does it feel like to just have that sort of in your, you know, in your proximity to yourself? I don't know. Like,
Yeah, this was part of the idea for the story. And, you know, stay tuned, listeners, because it might happen in some form still. But it was a couple years ago. The idea for the story was very much, you know, person who is completely opposed to guns gets one and tries to sort of figure out what the big deal is and, you know, gets trained and all that. And my experience was very interesting. So first off, in my gun, like, permit class, I was the only white person. Everyone else was black, the other students and the teacher. And that really changed the way people talked about why they wanted a gun. And even the teacher, you know, he was using NRA like slides because they make a lot of gun education materials. But he was very quick to say, like, I don't support their politics. And also talking about self-defense in racialized terms, which, again, it's the kind of thing where I'm like, you know, if this is what makes people feel safe and this is how they believe they can keep themselves safe, I can't blame anybody for feeling that way. But so that was a sort of a surprising community for me to be a part of in terms of my gun training and the way I like received the gun information that everybody who wants a gun permit in Maryland, which is where I got certified, has to go through. And then I also went shooting with a like leftist vegan who's an internet celebrity for rescuing neonatal cats. She's like a small femme cis woman with like long blonde hair and a lot of tattoos. She's very striking and beautiful. And when we went to this gun range, and she has a gun for self-protection and has, you know, personal reasons for doing that and feeling like she needs that protection. So we went shooting at the NRA range in Virginia, and a man started hitting on her. And it really felt like, not that it was necessarily harassment, but it was, it felt like this is not really a safe place for anybody to say like yes or no to a come on. And it made me think about what it would mean for queer and trans people to put themselves in the same spaces as other people who are shooting guns, who may not be, who might, you know, be a member of the Proud Boys that are going to show up at the Drag Queen Story Hour that you're arming yourself to counter protest. So but the thing that surprised me, and it probably shouldn't have, was that I could have gotten the permit without basically ever having shot a gun. So to get a concealed carry permit, the people who were getting one who lived in Maryland and wanted a Maryland certificate had to go through some sort of a shooting training and, you know, have like 70% accuracy or something. I got a different permit that worked in Virginia and 30 other states. It's called the Utah permit. And for that, I wouldn't have ever had to shoot a gun. And so I have this extraordinarily powerful machine in my home without the material to use it. Like you said, I don't have any bullets in it. But just knowing that I have this thing that I've shot now, I think, on three different occasions that could kill somebody. And, you know, I haven't used it in years. I, like, forget how to operate it, actually. It's frightening and sobering when I think about the fact that literally anyone could get one of these and could be carrying it at any point in time. When January 6th happened, and I live, you know, about a mile north of the Capitol or whatever, my wife was kind of like, should we keep your gun near the door? Like, in case one of these militia people, like, comes by and we need to threaten them? And I was like, what would we do with it? You know, we couldn't use it. I would not trust myself to fire it. We don't have bullets for it, even if I did. And I think you don't want to be threatening someone with a gun unless you're prepared to use it. But it did... you know, for like a split second, put me in that mindset of, would there ever be a scenario in which I would want a loaded weapon in my home? And the answer was definitely no.
Right.
I saw recently that a leftist group called the John Brown Gun Club, which has a lot of queer and trans members, but is not, I think, specifically an LGBTQ group, went to protect a drag event that was happening in Texas where armed right-wing militia type people were coming to protest. And while I felt grateful that there were counter protesters there that were as visually threatening as the right wing protesters, it was really scary to think about how easily that situation could turn into a mass death event or a mass injury event. Because it only takes one person, and, you know, emotions are high. We all know that like physical skirmishes can happen at these places and in confrontations like that. And when everyone's got a deadly weapon, it does not seem that difficult for it to spiral out of control. And so it's scary to watch, even when my knee-jerk reaction is a little bit like, fuck yeah, we're scary too.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself, as you're talking about that, being pretty convinced that I don't think that that sort of direct you know, force for force response is like the world I want to be in, right? Like that doesn't seem, that seems like a recipe for disaster, as you say. But I'm wondering, I don't really have an answer for this yet, but like, are there any alternatives that feel queerer? I mean, people, so in this sort of discourse that happened right after the shooting, people were looking back to the 1970s, specifically at these sort of safety patrols. I'm going to read just a quick paragraph from this book, Safe Space, Gay Neighborhood History and the Politics of Violence by Christina Hanhart, where she talks about this and sort of defines what we're talking about. So, gay safe streets patrols popped up and almost as quickly disappeared across San Francisco and New York during the 1970s. A priest and his following of mostly young gay men and trans women carried shotguns in San Francisco's Tenderloin. Gay men calling themselves butterflies blew whistles among pastel Victorians in the Castro, and guardian leather men relied on the threat of hypermasculinity in New York's Chelsea and San Francisco's south of Market. All were short-lived, and many were more stunts or promises than efforts at sustained vigilance. Nonetheless, they were a crucial part of the political landscape during the years after gay liberation and before AIDS. Those sound like interesting models, but as I was sort of reading up on them and reflecting on it, I'm not sure if they're applicable to this, or are they? Maybe that's a question for y'all. Do you think that something like that, where, you know, with the butterfly brigades, it was if street violence started to happen, everybody had these whistles and would start blowing to, like, you know, bring attention to the situation. Maybe that could work, but in like the hyper violent world that we live in now, I'm not sure. I don't know if Jules, if you have thoughts about that comparison.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's really interesting just, you know, listening to both of you, right? It's like part of this has to do with how much has changed historically in America, right? Because self-defense is like self-defense against what? Against who, right? In what context? And I mean, it's really interesting because on the one hand, things feel a lot more violent because of guns, right? But, you know, speaking historically, empirically, right, by all available measures and data, I mean, the 1960s and 70s were much, much more violent on the whole, in the aggregate, than anything, you know, since the 90s. I mean, we just don't live in particularly violent times, at least if that's a reference point, right, 60s and 70s. But the context was so different because there hadn't been the kinds of legal decisions, right, around that what the Second Amendment means. There hadn't yet been kind of reaction to Black militants arming themselves, particularly in California, you know, things that like Governor Reagan passed, legislation that he signed into law, you know, in response to Black Panthers. But also just like, I mean, I think about this all the time. For one thing, if we go back to Stonewall, right? Okay, a riot, but like, you know, famously, no one died at Stonewall. Well, one of the reasons is that self-defense at the time is all about the police. The police are the most dangerous public omnipresent force for queer and trans people. And it hits harder, right? If you're, you know, poor or unhoused or gender nonconforming or a person of color, right? But the resistance to the police at Stonewall was quite violent. Like, you know, I remember at a 50th anniversary event I attended in New York, I listened to Stonewall veterans talk about chasing, you know, NYPD up the streets of the Village and picking up trash can lids and beating the shit out of them, not killing them, but beating them up to disarm them. But one of the reasons they could do that is because those cops didn't have guns, right? But also then, you know, by the same token, they didn't have guns. They were at a bar, right? And they weren't going to have guns otherwise. It was never really a part of, like, gay liberation never really, like, floated the idea of, like, armed revolution.
So, and, sorry, just to clarify, police didn't carry guns back then?
Not routinely, beat cops. No, they would have had nightsticks, right? So that's things like the police were very violent. They beat gay people and trans people, specifically gender nonconforming people, a lot, right? And I mean, this is, I think, the really challenging part of it is a lot of those safety brigades and organizing responses that happened in the 70s. You know, I've spent a lot of time looking at one trans lib organization in Miami, and one of their biggest hot button issues is the police violence, that police would pick up, you know, trans women, you know, in Miami, in South Beach especially, you know, who are just like out and about. Some of them might be doing sex work, but some of them might just be hanging out or walking down the street, coming home from a bar. And like violence was incredibly, incredibly widespread. And a lot of it, though, is institutionally abetted. So it's the police taking you back to the station and then sexually assaulting you or raping you before releasing you, right? That is like one of the number one issues this trans organization I've been researching is trying to deal with, right? But they don't, but the cops aren't using guns, right? And so the idea of meeting that force, like you can't meet it with symmetrical force because they want to reduce sexual violence, they would never, it just doesn't make any sense, right? So they have to come up with all sorts of ways to obviously petition, right? You know, try and get policies changed, try and get it covered in the news, try and drum up public support, try and name and shame particular officers or precincts. But they also call on like other, they like, you know, this is a network that's like plugged into the, you know, into to Latino and Caribbean communities. They hold like ceremonies and, you know, like have curses put on officers. Wow. Yeah. You know, there's a famous example from Los Angeles in the 70s where gay lib people went to a police station after a gay man and a trans woman had been murdered by the cops, and they tried to collectively levitate the police station off the ground and make it disappear, right? And it's like, okay, well, obviously it didn't work, but like I kind of understand the dilemma there, because they're living in a time period where gun violence is just doesn't work the way or on the scale that it does today, but the everyday quality of lived violence is actually quite high. Mm-hmm. And the kind of idea of like, how do we keep ourselves safe? I think this conversation has to do with changing definitions of safety, right? And like, I think that 70s moment is also so much about how, you know, the sort of urban segregation of working class, LGBTQ people, queer and trans people in the bar scene in seedier, quote unquote, seedier neighborhoods like the Tenderloin, right? Or like, you know, different parts of New York City or whatever, just means that like people looking to exploit people or, you know, like that, like the idea of being at risk of interpersonal violence, just like in everyday life is sort of the omnipresent issue alongside the police, and that no one cares what happens there. Right. And so it's sort of this kind of like, we have to take care of ourselves because our whole lives are in an underground, but things are so different today. Right. Yeah. It's like, we still gather and go to bars and we still have our own spaces, and there is still class and racial segregation, obviously to an extreme extent. But there's this different sense of the public and the shared world, right? Where on the one hand, you know, queer and trans people have made a series of claims on being a part of the common world, the public, the nation, whatever, right? And so the violence has a different register, not just because it's gun violence and it's so spectacular, but also because it's seen as a symbolic attack on a huge like swath of a community that stretches across the country and maybe has support everywhere, versus like this era when it was like, well, no one looks out for us in the Tenderloin. Yeah, the police won't even investigate the girls if they get murdered while they're working, so we have to take care of ourselves, right? And I just think, again, it's like, I don't know, when we really dig into those differences, like they actually feel incredibly pronounced. Yeah. And I don't know, I mean, I certainly feel like it's not obvious to me what lesson to take away from any of that. In the 21st century, it just seems like the situation is just profoundly different. And actually, public space is really different now because those kinds of gay neighborhoods actually don't exist that much anymore. And the ones that do are very gentrified and very high income. And it actually, that's something that has really changed how people like respond to outbreaks of violence. Like, you know, if as recently has been reported in Chelsea, it seems like someone has been targeting, you know, gay men at bars, right? Well, like Chelsea is a really wealthy zip code now, and the people who live there and the people who own businesses have a series of direct connections to municipal levers of power and can make claims in really traditional, respectable ways that like in the 70s in Chelsea, right, they wouldn't have been able to. So I just think like there is a little bit of an apple oranges thing for me, right? That I think also, Christina, I feel like you were sort of narrating for us how that feels from the first person perspective, right? Where it's like, well, do I even feel empowered? And that kind of anecdote with your wife, right, about like January 6th, I think is so apt, right? Where it's like, what would we even do? And also like, what is that threat? How does that threat even make sense? Like, will it come to our front door, even though it's very close by, right? We just live in a really different time and space.
It's hard to know. When you talked about the whistleblowing, Brian, it made me think about just a general lack of willingness among people these days, or maybe ever, to intervene when something bad is happening. Even if they know something bad is happening. Two things happened recently that made me less sure that anybody would intervene, even in a non-mass shooting situation and just a person-on-person, like, gay bashing scenario. One was I got groped on the street in broad daylight at a bus stop and was yelling at the person who did it and sort of, like, kicked him, and he kind of stumbled away.
No one reacted. Everyone else just stood
there. And I was, like, crying, and literally just no one wanted to, like, come out of their own little bubble on their phone or whatever to say anything. And another, someone very close to me, a butch dyke, got just the other day, like, a man at Union Station yelling at her, "You're going to hell, you're gay, da-da-da." And everyone else in the taxi line just stood there and didn't even, like, ask if she was okay, much less confront the person doing it. And, you know, I think it would obviously be a very different situation in a queer space. You know, obviously there would be a lot more people to recognize that kind of, like, verbal harassment and do something about it. But I feel like the threshold for somebody to be willing to get involved has gotten so high. I have taken, like, de-escalation trainings that have nothing to do with disarming people, but are more about, like, trying to get verbal harassment to stop. Bystander intervention. There you go. And I think that's really useful for people. I would also like to know how to maybe disarm someone with a gun, just because that feels useful. And in fact, that's how the Club Q shooting was stopped before it became even more deadly, was somebody at the club who had military training said afterwards, a straight man, you know, knew what to do, and also said that he was, like, traumatized from being in the military and so was hypervigilant, which is a terrible situation and just extremely sad that that was the thing that sort of possibly allowed him to react so quickly. But if more of us had that kind of training, like, not just for it, when we're in trans and queer spaces, but when we're out in public, like, perhaps I'd feel
better. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I agree with you, and I guess in principle that it would be better if a lot more of us had that kind of de-escalation training or that bystander intervention training. However, having just attended one of those things, you lose something by doing this too. Like, now when I go to a space like a gay bar, where before I think the whole idea was to kind of, you know, let your hair down and be free and not be vigilant and the way that we are that queer people sort of tend to have to be in most of their lives. Suddenly now I'm, like, threat assessing, right? Like, I'm, like, looking around the room. Who's acting weird? Like, who am I to judge who's acting weird, right? Where are the exits? Like, all of those things that are absolutely good for safety and make sense steal some of, like, the joy out of those places. And I don't know if there's any way around that, but it just strikes me that, like, that guy that you mentioned who was certainly, you know, a hero, but at, like, what cost to himself, you know, like, that those skills and that vigilance came at a cost to him. I don't know. It makes me sad to think that the only way to protect ourselves and our queer family is to kind of give up. Maybe it's giving up naivete. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking about it the wrong way, but you know what I mean? It's like that you lose something when you become, trained in this way. And I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing, I mean, I don't think there are obviously definitive categorical answers to these questions, and that's partly why, you know, I think one of the reasons that we all felt like we wanted to talk about this on the show this month is just that it's not obvious how to make space to sit with the ambivalence. And, you know, one thing I'll say as someone who, for what it's worth, you know, studies violence, right, and has read a lot of scholarship on violence and has spent time sort of in the slightly dissociated, slightly alienating, but also kind of positively, you know, distanced kind of realm of academic analysis and thinking about other time periods too, is, like, you know, I think part of the challenge that we really face right now is that there are spectacular and discrete events of violence that understandably capture our attention, that take up a lot of space. You know, when people lose their lives, when people die, I mean, death often feels like, you know, the ultimate kind of referendum. And because gun violence is spectacularized, right? I mean, that is part of its sort of performance, so to speak. That's a bit of a perverse use of that word, but like because of that, of course, it gathers attention, and it feels, or it, in the way that it's so alarming, right, it asks the sort of question, like, is this the allegory for something, right? Are we at the beginning of some sort of more widespread violence? But also, I think often then we become so fastened to like life or death questions, right? Part of the challenge, and I think part of what maybe, you know, talking about the 60s and the 70s also reminds us, is that there are other scales of suffering, and there are frankly other scales or speeds of death that are very slow, that wear people out over decades. There is all sorts of premature death that queer and trans people statistically in the aggregate experience, because we have to deal with so much shit in the world. We don't live as long. We are more likely to be ill. We don't have access to the same healthcare and resources, right? We have to live in different parts of town, and those are compounded by race and class in such intense ways. And I think part of the challenge then, right, is like, as we continue to think about what safety means or what even community feels like, right, it's sort of like, well, you know, what degrees of harm feel central, and how do we know, right, whether, like, you know, trying to save lives in one discrete, you know, zone of violence, how do we know what its relationship is to sort of this much larger scale, where it's harder to feel something, right? I mean, I think that's one of the challenges I know I feel as someone trying to speak publicly about the attacks on trans people, where I'm like, well, there are all these spectacular versions. There is the threat, people being murdered. There's the specter of suicide. There's just lives that wear out. And there are just, those are the, that's the numeric majority of people. And I do care about them. And I think that it's weird. It's frustrating to me that we just don't have very much vocabulary for talking about that. I think in part because we're so hung up on how hard it is to talk about these really intense forms of violence. And, you know, I don't say that as if that's offering a prescription to do something. You know, I think it's just really complicated. And I think that that's part of the dizzying moment that we're living in, where there's so much rising tide of discrete violence, but it's also on the backs of so much misery in this country, right? And like, that's hard to quantify. That's much harder to digest, right? Unfortunately, right? Like, the nervous system can turn on that vigilance, and you can feel that rush of cortisol and understand and imagine also from like growing up on TV and movies what it would be like to be in a highly violent, short-lived situation, like a shooting, right? But it's much harder to sit with and just be like, what does it mean that on the whole queer and trans people are suffering in X, Y, you know, Z ways, you know, right now? I think that's a lot harder to kind of wrap our head around. And I just feel like that's part of the riddle to me that this legacy of organizing is reminding us, is like, well, you know, if the police are still statistically more dangerous to us than strangers or militia, or if poverty ultimately is going to be the thing, you know, that harms the most of us, not to say be utilitarian, pick and choose based on that, but just what does that do to our calculus, right? But also, how do we feel our way through those things? And I'm not sure. I think it's really hard. You can think about them. You can look at numbers on a page or whatever, but to feel that, right? It's a lot harder to feel that in your body, I think.
Yeah. I really appreciate that reframing.
Well, I think that is a good place to end that conversation. Like we said, no super clear answers, but if you listeners have thoughts about queer self-defense, militancy, what we should be doing to take care of each other in these times, please share it with us. You can write to outwardpodcast@slate.com.
This month, we are excited to talk about a new film that tries to give us a new way to understand the lives of trans people living in mid-20th century America, and also how the stories we think we know from the trans past inform what we think about trans lives today. It's a documentary called Framing Agnes, directed by Chase Joint, and it centers on a set of six trans people who were interviewed and treated at UCLA's gender clinic in the 1950s. One of the things that makes this film interesting, in addition to the gorgeous critical and historical commentary throughout from our very own Jules Gill Peterson, who is just impossibly glamorous in this documentary, my God, is the format of the film. So it comprises a series of reenactments in which six trans actors play the parts of those people whose stories were in the UCLA archives. So we see the transcripts of their interviews with the Dr. Harold Garfinkel brought to life. And those scenes are interspersed with interviews with the actors themselves as themselves, reflecting on the people they're embodying, how their own lives resonate with those people from the past, and on how all trans stories, even contemporary ones, get packaged and told and remembered by people who have the power to do those things. We're so excited to be joined by Jen Richards, who portrays the trans woman Barbara in the film. You might have also seen Jen in Tales of the City or Mrs. Fletcher, both fabulous shows that we've discussed on Slate podcasts. Jen, it's such a pleasure. Welcome to Outward.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you start by giving us an introduction to Barbara and how you sort of brought yourself into her life and her world?
Barbara was a discovery of Chase and the rest of his research partners. I've been following Chase's work with Agnes and with this archive for a long time, and he was so excited when he made this discovery of these additional subjects of these interviews and this research at UCLA. And he came to me with Barbara. Part of the genius of what Chase did in terms of the casting of the additional trans participants is to kind of sync up some of the issues that come out through their interviews with the real life work of those of us who are doing these parts. And Barbara was a hyper-connected trans woman at that time. She's someone who was very much in the know, knew the trans community in Los Angeles, was very aware about all the different doctors and the kind of work they were doing, their different reputations, even kind of slyly and proudly claims knowledge of a certain Hollywood star who is secretly trans that no one knows about. And my work in the trans community had originally started kind of on the activism and advocacy side of things. And I had done a lot of work that was geared towards bringing trans people together and creating community amongst trans people before I segued into doing on-camera performance work. And so Barbara felt very much like a touchstone for me, a kind of clear ancestor to the kind of work that I was already doing, which was a really exciting discovery for me, just on that surface level in terms of interests, in terms of connection. And then to discover her personality in the transcript, her kind of combativeness, her clear certainty that she knows more than Garfinkel, the kind of way that she holds a mirror back up to Garfinkel through the interviews and shows his own ignorance, which then kind of underlines the power differences between them is quite beguiling.
Oh, yeah, totally. I felt like, and you kind of mentioned this in the film, that Barbara's confidence and self-possession really comes through in the transcript. And you have to imagine that being in a situation like having an interview with a doctor who holds all manner of power over the person being interviewed, like, that couldn't have been an incredibly comfortable or easy situation to be in for Barbara. And yet she, it almost seems like she knows that he's the one who's getting the privileged treatment here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. She has the confidence of someone who doesn't need him. Mm-hmm. She knows her own mind. She knows the different paths available before her and knows that this isn't the sole gatekeeper of what she needs. And so she can kind of dance around him as needed.
So the film starts with and sort of centers on the figure of Agnes, who is a semi sort of well-known figure in trans history. What role does Agnes sort of play in this documentary in terms of what we want to learn about the other characters and what their stories say about the fact that, you know, Agnes is the one whose history got told?
Yeah, so we know about Agnes because she kind of became famous for you know, something that she did, you know, when she was at UCLA, and for her relationship with these doctors. It was tumultuous and complicated enough. I don't want to give away a kind of important point that gets revealed in the film, but it was, you know, interesting enough that those doctors just wrote a lot about her. And so she kind of exists like a lot of trans people from the past as a case study, right? Someone written about in a literature review, right? And so like sociologists had talked about Agnes for a really long time as a kind of, you know, warning about how untrustworthy and sort of suspicious trans people are. But then like, I think trans people a little bit later, you know, maybe in the 90s and the 2000s started to reclaim her and say like, ah, yeah, it's really cool that we sometimes have to make up stories and we have to like, you know, do complicated things to get what we want. And that makes us sort of, you know, kind of heroes, or it's a sort of heroic endeavor. But that's the only reason why we know so much about her. And so all of these other transcripts, right, are from people who were there at the same time, who are talking to the same, you know, doctors and researchers, but who just for whatever reason didn't rise to the status of being important enough to be written about and just didn't get that kind of profile. And so Agnes is a really weird sort of person in relation to someone like Barbara, you know, because, you know, Jed, you're just talking about how well connected Barbara was, whereas it seems like Agnes is kind of a more isolated person, you know, who is on a sort of transition journey. And, you know, when that journey arrives somewhere she's happy with, she kind of disappears from the record and we never hear from her again. And sure, we never hear from Barbara again either, but like Barbara just lets on so much about her life. And I think we really see that kind of difference dramatized, you know, in the way that Zachary Drucker brings Agnes to life versus sort of the way that you bring Barbara to life. And I think something just happens, right? When it's like, we just don't have to pin all of the 1950s on Agnes's shoulders anymore. It doesn't all have to be this one, you know, trans woman from the 50s who like is doing a lot, right? But I just think like, I don't know. I mean, it's in the film, we meet Agnes first and then Barbara's actually the next person we meet. And there's something so interesting to me about that, because the way it's like, you know, those two people are never technically, you know, diegetically in the room at the same time, but they're going through the same thing. And sometimes we cut between them and it's just like a whole different atmosphere, a whole different vibe, to use 2022 language. I'm sort of curious, like when you were coming to Barbara, I mean, obviously you were just saying there are parts of her that you really connected to, but do you feel like you also had this sort of like Agnes style image of trans women from the 50s, like stuck in, I mean, I'm just sort of curious what the other reference points were. I mean, you've actually also played like trans women from history before. So I mean, actually, I'm sure you had a lot more, you know, coming into your process and decision making there, you know, as an actor. But I'm just sort of curious, because I feel like Agnes is more the typical imagination people have of the 50s. Isolated trans woman. Yeah. Who is sort of mysterious. We don't really know that much about her, but also ultimately she kind of just blends in and is a very conventional picture of, say, like white middle-class domesticity. And Barbara feels just different to me. I don't know.
Absolutely. I have to cast my mind back to prior to my own coming out. So, you know, 15 or 20 years ago when I was first reading about trans people and trying to figure out whether or not I was trans, I did have this very kind of narrow sense of what it meant to be trans. And one of the aspects of the way that trans lives have been framed, and not just from the outside in, but also even, you know, to ourselves, like the kinds of, you know, message boards that I was on once upon a time, or even just perusing magazines, there was the kind of dominant narrative was that, at least for trans women, I think also true for trans men, but specific for trans women, the goal was to pass and to do what we call go stealth, which means you transition, you know, very neatly from one box to another. You know, you're in the boy box and you transition to the girl box. And once you can successfully do that, you disappear. There's no sense that there was an ongoing community, that there was any kind of sense of a debt to community, of a sense of service or what you owed, or like a historical legacy that you are a part of. It's just you. It was almost like this medical condition that is kind of tragic that you have it. You try and get it fixed, and then you just assimilate in life. And what that means is, for every generation of successful trans people, there's a disappearance. There's a disappearance from archives, from public records. There's a disappearance of what was learned in the course of that person's transition, of the kind of community that they had, the kind of support that they had to go through that, you know, what skills and talents they gained. And then also the way, like the other things that that person was capable of doing and what they did in the world. There might have been very successful, you know, trans politicians and actors and lawyers and doctors that we simply mm-hmm. don't know about. There's this continual erasure, both from the outside and from within the community. And I remember when I finally decided to transition, when I finally accepted the fact that I was trans, it felt very much like a death sentence at the time. You know, it was this thing, like, I remember reading several times on different kinds of blogs at the time that only transition if your only other option is suicide. Like, wow, that was the way that it was seen. Like, don't do this unless you're at the point where it's death or transition, because your life is going to be so much worse after transition. And you kind of had to accept that. You were going to lead this, like, sad, lonely life where you were constantly having to lie to everybody about who you were and hide this aspect of yourself and your past. And instead, I found quite the opposite. When I came out, and some of this is a result of, you know, the sudden prominence of social media. Some of it's just an accident of the kind of friend groups that I found in my own personality. But I immediately found so much community and became so invested in growing that community and making that community more visible that I was shocked at how many trans people were around and how happy their lives were for the most part. Like, I was like, how come no one ever talks about this part, about how things are so much better? Your relationships are richer. Mm-hmm. You feel more authentic, more yourself, more free. And you're also freed from this kind of crippling anxiety that I had carried throughout my life. And I wanted to talk more about that. So Agnes was very much my sense of what it meant to be trans prior to actually transitioning. And then Barbara is very much my sense of what it means to be trans after transitioning. And I love that we get both of those. And a question I have for you, Jules, because I'm really intrigued, is why is it that Agnes was elevated to that position within literature and academia? How come it's that we had this view of Agnes of being definitive of what a trans experience was versus Barbara, someone who was confident and in loving relationships and in a very widespread and robust community of trans people?
Why did we get Agnes and not Barbara? Wow, that's such a good question. I mean, I think you kind of just answered it for us, though, because I'm not sure that that dilemma has ended, right? Like, I think you were just telling us a little bit about it again, you know, from your own experience, and I can certainly relate to versions of that, too, where it's like, Agnes was a good story for the doctors, for conventionality. She was a better story for kind of 1950s America, right? Because in that sense, it's like she's trying to be quote unquote normal in the way other people perceive her. Doesn't matter what she really thought and wanted. The point is how other people see her. And so her failure or success at that, either way, that doesn't really rock the boat, right? Either she succeeds and disappears, right? And then we can be like, we did a good job, right? We helped someone be a better woman. And then presumably she went on to be a housewife, right? Or if she failed, we can dismiss it and say that's her failure. That was on her, right? And we don't really have to change anything about the world that we live in. Whereas, like, I just think, like, Barbara was a lot more threatening. I mean, and I think that's the thing that you bring to life so intensely and so beautifully, in the way that you sort of let Barbara have this extra level of knowledge that she's sort of, it's so sly, right? Like, I think a lot comes through in the way, in the pacing, in the tone of how you deliver lines, the pauses you take, the incredible facial expressive work that you're doing, right? There's all this extra language that it's like, it's not even obvious if Garfinkel, you know, played by Chase Joint, is, you know, is even receiving it. I have to also imagine that the real Barbara was like that, or that there were trans women like that back then, because there are trans women like that today. And I feel like those people, because they let that little bit of like, hey, I know what's going on here better than you, right? No one wants to deal with the implications of that, because that means that the ones who are the sad, tragic deviants, that we're actually like a little better at this game called life, right? Yeah. And like, the people in power aren't going to enjoy that. So I think it's no mistake, right, that Barbara went there, had this, you know, series of interviews or even just one interview, and then they were like, let's just put that in the filing cabinet and never touch it, right? Because it doesn't, it, she really rocked the boat. I have to believe that that fault line in the 50s is just like traveling all the way to the present day, right? It just feels so real to me now, but I don't think it's because we're projecting it from today backwards. I really feel like we inherit that fault line.
Let's play a clip from the film to hear some of the way Barbara conducted herself.
I'd say I know
22 of the 36 women in town who have had the operation. Even that Hollywood star, well, I shouldn't say her name. Whenever we hear about someone who's been arrested for cross-dressing, we reach out. There's a group of us. We do hospital visits after someone's operation so they won't be alone. We talk to each other about what hospitals to avoid. I can always tell who's had which procedure by how nice the room is or how long the stay.
I was wondering if we could hear from you both a little bit about the experience of making this movie, because it's such a, it's, you know, Christina, I think you did an admirable job of trying to explain it in your introduction, but I've not really seen anything like it with the mix of reenactments of sort of, you know, talking head interviews, with sort of sit down discussions between the actors and the director. All of that's being done sort of at once and mixed together in this really fascinating way for the viewer. But I was wondering what it was like to do all of those various kinds of performance, I guess you could call it all performance, as an actor, as an academic.
It was weird, and I did not understand what we were doing. I was quite confused. I've done quite a few talking head interviews, and I've done you know quite a bit of performance, but this particular blend, and it wasn't just that we were doing two things. It was really we were doing kind of at least three things, because there were the reenactments, which were verbatim from the transcripts and done, you know, in character, on a set, and, you know, shown in black and white. But then they were also capturing moments between Chase and I, you know, as we were figuring out how to approach the transcripts and all that. And then there were the interviews with us still, like, in our hair and makeup from the character, but in our own clothes just off of the set. Then there was the kind of reenactments of our lives. So for my scenes, it was at a hair salon that I worked at. And so I was doing that. And then interviews with me as totally as myself, like dressed hair and makeup as myself in that space. So there were at least like four or five different things that were happening. And I had absolutely no idea how this was going to turn out. I never understood, like, how is this going to work as a movie? It really didn't make sense. And also, when we shot the short version of it and did these interviews, Jules wasn't involved yet. And it didn't totally work. Like, I always felt like something was missing. And it was when I saw the final form with Jules that it was such a revelation of, like, oh, that's the piece that was missing. That's what threads this all together. So I confess, I never really understood what we were doing until I saw it. You know, you commit to each little piece of it. Like, okay, I'm here and it look like this and I'm talking about these things and I'll make that work. But there was a little meta part of my brain that's just like, how is this going to come together as a movie and create a pleasurable viewing experience that I could not conceive until I saw it.
Was there anything about that sort of smorgasbord of performance that changed the way you felt about Barbara and her story's resonance with your own life?
It certainly underscored the similarities. That I mean, that's always the case. One part of the nature of any kind of performance, if you give it any kind of real attention and effort, is that ultimately it spills over, because the kind of key to making a good performance is finding those resonances in yourself, and then, you know, you just kind of carry that through your mind for the whole period that you're doing it. I just wrapped up doing Shakespeare for the last 3 months, and I'm still very much like in my character and thinking about the way things that she does. It's just one of the, you know, workplace hazards of our profession. So for me, the big thing, and I think I might have even mentioned this in the film, is that Barbara's confidence and kind of conviction were really intriguing to me and seemed foreign to me at the time. I didn't feel like I moved the world with her kind of confidence of, like, I know who I am, I know where I belong, I know how to access what I need, and I'm not concerned about people, you know, getting in my way, because I know what needs to be done. I felt like I've gained that sense, and I do think some small part of it is Barbara kind of getting into me. And, like, once you embody that and you feel it in your bones, like, oh, I like how this feels. I like moving through the world in this way. And I'm going to take that little bit of Barbara moving forward.
I think that's why Barbara's just so lovable. I mean, I feel like every time I watch the film, I'm always just, I mean, it's also your performance, Jen, it's just incredible, but like, there is something about that confidence that's infectious. I mean, it just, I don't know. And even has interesting, like, almost counterintuitive effects, because I would say the same thing, even though I'm, you know, the one person ostensibly not acting in the film, you know, this being a part of the project and actually, like, really, like, it's so weird to me now, because I like tell people, like, I came in at the end of this project, and one of the really interesting things that we did to prepare for me being narrator was just watching a kind of rough assembly of a lot of the footage shot so far. And so I kind of sat with, you know, each of the people, including Barbara, and just sort of, we had some conversations that night, and then the next day walk in, you know, to the set and get ready to just sit down in the chair, right? And I was so nervous because I'd never done something like that before. And I was like, okay, well, I know how to be a scholar or a professor, but like Chase had invited me to also be me. And I was like, well, I don't normally get to do that. You know, in my day job, I'm a professor. Sure. I'm very confident. I think I'm good at what I do. But like, you know, there haven't really been like trans women of color, you know, on the history faculty in many universities, And so, you know, I always feel like I'm just making a shit up as I go along in life anyways. And I was like, so I can sort of understand why I'm here. But I was like, but I want to get somewhere. And I feel like, you know, just being a part of this ensemble and team had this kind of, you know, transformative effect that I feel like, you know, when people go and watch a movie, I'm like, you're watching in real time the birth of like this Jules, you know, the one who's sitting here right now talking very candidly and very calmly and with less, like, you know, I'm a Capricorn, so like I can do this now with a lot less you know, over preparation than I used to. And so like there's a kind of confidence for me that's about vulnerability, because I maybe, you know, had the kind of plucky, well, I'll show you that I know everything kind of thing going for me my whole life, but not this sort of slow down, sit in it and see how it feels, see what else you want to communicate. And I just think there's something really interesting, because I love what you were saying, Jen, that like it's not like, oh, this could only happen in acting trans parts. Clearly, it's just like part of acting brings up all of these questions about the relationship of the self to performance and how you kind of get infected by ideas or moments or feelings. But on the other hand, I just feel like because of the history of trans representation, that kind of, you know, coming together as a team to be able to both be kind of exceptional and performance driven and also pull back for moments of vulnerability that are sort of less produced, like that feels, I don't know, that continues to kind of dazzle me. And I just want like more of that in the world for everyone all the time. I feel like it's just like, it's a good in itself, you know, and it feels nice to just be part of something that's kind of pushing that agenda out into the world.
One of the things that the panoply of different formats this film takes did for me was really underscore, and obviously this is one of the themes of the film, how our understanding of other people's experiences are always mediated through something. And so in the case of these interviews, even though they're trans people speaking their lives in their own words, they're being prompted by a cis person, you know, a cis white man who's a doctor, who's a, you know, university or faculty member. So it's not exactly like an unvarnished depiction of someone's life. Even if we were reading their diaries, it wouldn't be, right?
Right.
And when the actors in the film and you, Jules, and Chase are talking about their own understanding of trans stories and how they came to their own identities, people talked about, you know, talk shows, seeing sort of trans and gender nonconforming people on talk shows. Jen, you mentioned message boards. It feels like both back then and today, our understanding of what it means to be any person in the world, but also a trans person in the world, is always coming through some sort of middle space that can distort it. I wonder if you could speak to how, what you think the film can teach us about that, and also what sort of stands out to you as that middle space today when we're trying to understand trans lives.
Jules really extended my thinking about this issue of how we encounter others because of the way that she talks, particularly about Georgia, who's a Black trans woman played by Angelica Ross, and Jules kind of anticipates what the audience feels and then complicates it at each step of the way. So Georgia comes on, and as a Black trans woman, she has a unique set of issues, and you can really feel her kind of often rage, often a little bit of grief and frustration, but also her strength and resilience. And it creates all kinds of loaded feelings for me in particular as an audience member, as a trans person, but I suspect anyone watching it. And then Jules immediately takes that and then like turns the mirror around and makes you as the audience ask why you feel that way about Georgia, and whether that actually says anything about Georgia, and if instead it really just says something about you. And it's part of what I think is so great about this movie is I don't think I would have asked myself those kinds of questions, particularly in a documentary with really compelling subjects. I'm just kind of swept along and interested in their narratives. And I do feel this kind of instinctual human, oh, I wish things had been easier for her, or I wish she could have had this, or like, oh, I'm so inspired. And then Jules just kind of complicates all that. And then all of a sudden I feel unsettled, and I suddenly look at everyone on screen in a different kind of way of like, oh yeah, like I'm just projecting all of my own feelings on that. And there's all these other questions that I'm not asking. Jules raises this really incredible question in the film about whether or not the people who were erased from this narrative might have benefited from the erasure, from not being as such visible. And it's like, damn, I never thought of that. Like, it never would occur to me to think about that.
The value of invisibility. So this idea,
the value of invisibility and the ways in which our encounters with the past and with other trans people are so deeply mediated by these different kinds of formats, whether it's a talk show or, you know, message boards. I think the kind of, I don't want to say sad truth underlying that, but clearly part of the issue, because this is so common that we first see trans people on screens or, you know, in literature studies, is the lack of visibility of trans people in, you know, regular life, and the lack of spaces by which we can encounter each other as whole human beings in real space and real time. And it is kind of curious to think of what our sense of ourselves would be like if we had, you know, if like your first encounter, you know, like if you're a gay man or a lesbian woman, maybe in high school, and there's a GSA, or you have like a crush, and like the ways that you encounter your own queerness through actual people in the real world, how different that is, and how that structures your sense of queerness differently than a trans person who might not even know that they're trans until they see a movie or see a character on a TV show, like, oh, that's what I'm experiencing, that's what I'm feeling. And when all of those depictions have been made by cis people and are often, you know, rent through with disgust or hostility or mockery, what that does for our own self-image, like it's really powerful. And then it loads you with a sense of a kind of an additional layer of responsibility, and that since we're doing this here with this movie, we are putting more trans narratives out there, more trans people on screens, and knowing that some people will be encountering both us and themselves for the first time through this medium while being hyper aware of that impact, it's kind of dizzying.
It's like our lives are just so dramatic, but not because we choose for them to be, right? Like, you just sort of, I think, gave a beautiful account of how, like, when you're trying to pull your inside out to be able to live in who you're reasonably certain you actually are, you find that what you're pulling out of your inside is actually the distillation of a culture's 1 million fantasies about people like you. And that causes just such a bizarre fracture in the self that I think, you know, it certainly happens to other people, but it's uniquely a trans thing too. And I think one of the interesting questions is like, how do we ride the drama, which we are riding that drama in this film, but how could we ride it somewhere kind of like to the point where I feel like, to me, the answer is not better representation or subtracting all the negative things or whatever. It's actually like, can we just get to a place where it's not a big deal that we encounter other people through through a medium, right? That our idea about others is mediated. That should be normal. That should be unremarkable. It shouldn't be so high stakes. And I feel like, again, I just feel like I'm just projecting everything I want to be true onto Barbara and saying she did it for us. But I feel like, you know, Jed, you just,
just, again, Barbara's slyness, I feel like it's just this quiet testimony to, like, oh no, I know how it really could be. It's not a big deal to me. I'm very happy and self-satisfied. And even if she, you know, was sort of performing that in the moment, or you were emphasizing that in your performance, it's so powerful to just sit with that as a kind of manifesto for, like, things not being a big deal, for us to accept the limitations of the way we move through the world as interesting but not devastating problems, and for those problems not to be pinned on the backs of trans people to validate everybody else's bullshit about their gender, because, like, gender is full of bullshit. That's cool. Like, let's just, you know, like, let's chill. Things get really interesting when we relax a little bit.
And I don't know about you, Jules, but for me, just, like, just knowing that, I live in Los Angeles, and just knowing that Barbara was here and part of a large and thriving community with many, many trans people that long ago changes my sense of my own, you know, like, my ancestors, but also, like, being part of an ongoing legacy, and puts lie to what is kind of implied by so much of the anti-trans rhetoric today, that it's like, it's a fad, it's new, it's something we don't know about, oh, we need to slow down, we're still figuring this out, give people time to, you know, to adjust, they're still learning. It's like, but no, like, we, like, I just played someone who, you know, 70 years ago was part of this thriving community. So I just did a mostly trans and non-binary production of Shakespeare's As You Like It. I played the part of Celia, the two female leads in As You Like It are Rosalind and Celia, and they were both played by a trans woman in this production. And as part of my, like, my research, and I've always been a big Shakespeare buff, but I found out that there were these two, you know, boy, and I'm doing that with scare quotes, actors who joined, you know, Shakespeare's troupe in the late 1590s, and and their names are lost to history, but these two boy actors were apparently so good at playing adult women on stage that Shakespeare created first Beatrice and Hero and Much Ado About Nothing, and then the two female leads in Henry V, and then Portia and Calpurnia and Julius Caesar, then Rosalind and Celia and As You Like It, and then Gertrude and Ophelia and Hamlet, in a row. Like, oh, these, like, God, these classic pairs, like, these, like, female heroines. Shakespeare had never written such complicated women with such rich and interesting lives, and female characters hadn't been given so much to do on stage were it not for these two quote-unquote boy actors. And, like, of course they were trans women. You know, we didn't have the language for that then, but of course they were. Their whole lives were spent embodying womanhood on stage, and, like, really complicated women that are still, you know, rich to this day. And like, I realized, like, oh, we really have always been here. The ways in which we manifest, the ways in which we're made visible, the ways in which our experiences are made legible by popular culture, by ourselves, and by our community are constantly shifting and depend upon, you know, historical and geographic and all kinds of sociopolitical circumstances. But that doesn't erase the fact that we've always been here. And to suddenly discover and have that realization about, for me, for Shakespeare's time, and then also for Barbara, like, in my own community in Los Angeles, is... it gives me a sense of security and a connection of just a sense of belonging that stretches across both time and space in a way that I found incredibly empowering.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but what a beautiful way to end our conversation. Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Truly my pleasure.
Well, Framing Agnes, it debuted at Sundance this year. It's now in limited release. There's potentially a wider release in the works. So stay tuned, utilize your Google device, and definitely go see it.
All right, that's about it for this month. But before we go, as always, one last time though, for 2022, we've got your monthly updates to the gay agenda. Christina, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, so the holidays are approaching. And I don't know about you guys, but I have been taking out my credit card, buying a lot of stuff online for my loved ones, and I wanted to recommend two queer spots on the interweb to buy gay shit. You might not be able to get these things in time for Christmas or whatever, just based on when this episode airs, but it's never the wrong time to buy gay shit on the internet. So I want to shout out The Little Gay Shop, It's thelittlegayshop.com. There's incredible books there, zines, art. I found socks with the word butts on them. Just really anything gay, and also a lot of queer stuff that you wouldn't be able to find in any sort of mainstream online gift marketplace. It's very cute. The other one I want to recommend is a place I'd actually been in person, but they have an online shop too. It's called Adam's Nest in Keytown. And I got a set of note cards there, like sort of blank inside note cards, which I actually think is a great gift for people because it's always nice to have like really stylish and beautiful note cards around for the unexpected occasion you might need to write a card to someone for. And they have not just note cards, but a lot of other like fun collaborations with artists. Apropos of this episode, they have shirts that say shoot loads, not guns. Part of the sales of which goes to Gays Against Guns. And they do, a lot of their products are sort of like in collaboration with, or, you know, the proceeds, part of the proceeds go to a certain like LGBTQ organization. It's just a really fun collection of gay stuff. And, you know, if you're going to be a consumer of goods, you might as well consume a shirt that says shoot loads, not guns. Again, that spot is called Adam's Nest. You can find it at adamsnest.com. Jules, what do you want to recommend?
So I know we've already, you know, kind of movied ourselves. That's not on this episode. But I have a kind of another movie recommendation, but I haven't seen the movie yet. So I'm going to make the recommendation through a lovely review piece by a dear friend and very talented thinker and writer, Eva Pensis, who just published a piece on December 9th in the LA Review of Books titled Not a Transition. It's a piece about a new film by the filmmaker Andrea Palaro, titled Monica. This is this wonderful new film starring Trace Lissette, the wonderful, talented, incomparable Trace Lissette. And it's a really interesting film that, you know, Pensis writes about as being a kind of trans film that really pushes, again, the question of, like, what is a trans film? It's not a film about transition. It's a film about, you know, someone needing to go home to be with, you know, an ill or, you know, ailing mother, and brings up a lot of really interesting kind of, you know, questions around trans life without sort of doing it in a kind of didactic, sort of overly, you know, tell me kind of way. And I think makes it, you know, seem like a bit more of a beautiful kind of mundane meditation. Anyways, I really encourage folks to maybe, you know, go and read Eva's piece and sort of, you know, let that be your portal to thinking about going to see the film. But I just, you know, to me, it's like, of course, holidays, I want to catch up on movies while I'm taking a little break, but also just sort of, you know, really shouting out to this moment where there is now, I just think, a wider swath of stories that are being told that are like, I guess, trans stories, but in the sense that what a trans story is has changed a lot. And I think it's actually sometimes those successes can be kind of quiet because they don't come at you with that sort of sensational story like we were talking about earlier. So it looks like a gorgeous movie. I mean, I just think Trace Lissette is just like a treasure. And Eva wrote really beautifully about it. So highly recommend catching that piece at the LARB and then going to see Monica in a theater near you. Brian, what have you got for us?
I have got a cocktail for you. So I'm calling it the Cuddle Puddle.
You invented it?
Well, you invented so it's based, I'm going to give half credit. It's based on another cocktail called the Semester Abroad that I discovered by the mixologist Anders Ericsson, but I have adapted it.
Wow, I didn't realize that cocktails had bylines.
You know, there's only like four real cocktails in the world. It's like they're all variations on the thing. So, but I to be totally forthcoming, I did started with his recipe, but changed it quite a bit. So it's called the Cuddle Puddle. I call it that because it's really the soft, warm blanket that you can sort of wrap yourself in. Mm. Maybe it helps you muffle a little of the stress that comes from this time of year. It's cozy, it's boozy, it's calming. It has sort of a ginger orange spice thing happening. So if you're into that, that's what it is. And I'll give you the recipe quickly. It is 2 ounces of rye, 1 ounce ginger liqueur, a half ounce of Fernet Branca or like a similar sort of spicy Amaro like that, and then just a dash of orange bitters. And you're going to stir it a long time over ice, strain that into your cocktail glass, and then if you want, you can garnish it with an orange peel. But it is lovely and a very nice thing to tuck into sort of at the end of the night when you're having your holiday feelings. So the Cuddle Puddle. We'll put it on the show page so people can see it.
Wow, it's a bespoke
gift agenda.
You're recommending a thing that you made. I love that.
And I also want to say, I'm just this, you know, I know taste is a little subjective, but I feel like you've constructed a cocktail that is both gay and lesbian, and therefore, dare I say, bisexual in some other third thing, right? Like, beautiful. You're giving all the notes. So this is really a drink for everyone, except, of course, folks who don't
indeed.
Drink.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. I didn't set out with such high hopes, but I'm pleased. Well, that is the end of the show and the end of 2022. As always, if you have feedback or topic ideas, you can send them to us at outwardpodcast@slate.com or reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter, I guess, maybe if that still exists, at Slate Outward. June Thomas is our producer and the top monarch of our own little butterfly brigade. If you like Outward, and you know you do, please subscribe if you haven't already, tell your friends about it, rate and review the show so that others can find it and enjoy it with you. We will be back in your feeds on January 18th. Until then, happy holidays, everyone, and here's to making the next year the queerest one it can be.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.